I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Seth Limmer, the winner of the 2015 Eisendrath Award for the Journey for Justice Walk with the Torah from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C. last summer. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I spent two busy days this past week in the Colorado Mountains visiting friends and talking about Israel and the American Jewish community's relationship to it. I had the chance to talk with a variety of prominent American Jewish figures about just how we here in the United States now view Israel. And in the drive down from the mountains to the Denver airport, I participated in a rabbinic conference call with two outstanding Israeli figures on very much the same subject. The question addressed was just how we Jews here in America perceive Israel right now, and how much of what we actually think about Israel's policies towards the Palestinians we can actually say in public. Generally speaking, Jews aren't afraid of saying anything public about anyone, so this is a little bit of a surprising topic. But in view of the current situation in Israel and the West Bank, and the politics of the American Jewish world, this has become a significant flashpoint. If you are a strong supporter of Israel, as I am, how much can you criticize her, and should you do it in public? If you are a critic of Israel, just when do you cross over from constructive criticism to demonization? And if you are an ardent advocate for Israel, do you have the right to try to silence legitimate criticism from others who support her, but think differently on some issues? Finally, what the younger generations of American Jews think about Israel today? All of this may seem like a tempest in a pro-Israel teapot, but trust me when I say that passions run high. There are very serious conversations being held here and in Israel at very high levels about these challenges. It affected the American presidential primaries, and it may have a significant impact on the final election, too. Little background. You're probably familiar with APAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which has been a very strong advocate for Israel here in America for about 40 years. APAC was actually founded way back in 1951, but it only grew effective enough to make a difference in the 1970s. APAC is considered to be to the right on Israel. Recent years, it's always been closely aligned with whatever government was in power in Israel, which for the past 8 years has been Bibi Netanyahu's Likud-led coalition. Throughout its history, APAC has been careful to be perceived as supporting Israel's needs and protecting Israel's safety in the region by working collegially with American representatives, the president, and especially Congress, to promote a justified, positive image of Israel and to lobby for her security. Since the collapse of the Oslo process, about 16 years ago, APAC has not had much use for the possibility of a Palestinian state, nor has it seen the need for Israel to ultimately withdraw from the West Bank as a strategic or moral choice. In recent years, an alternative pro-Israel lobbying group called J Street has risen to prominence, more liberal than APAC, but still very supportive of Israel's security and other needs. J Street is much smaller than APAC, but it has grown steadily and provides a different voice for Israel on Capitol Hill and to the White House. J Street promotes a two-state solution, one for Jews, the State of Israel, one for Palestinians, the potential nation of Palestine, and it sees ending the occupation of the West Bank as a strategic and moral necessity for Israel. We've had APAC and J Street guests here on Two Jewish, including Jeremy Ben-Ami, the head of J Street, and we continue to invite prominent APAC leaders to join us. Last summer, July 2015, President Obama brought the Iran nuclear pact to Congress. The international sanctions would be eased on Iran in exchange for inspections to verify they weren't making an atomic bomb. for reasons we talked about here on Too Jewish and which still don't make much sense, AIPAC followed Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's lead and fought the Iran Accord tooth and nail. The problem with this strategy was arithmetic. AIPAC needed to convince two-thirds of the Senate to vote against the president, and it never had the votes to win. Even after a very vigorous campaign against the nuclear treaty and a huge outlay of funds for a national ad campaign opposing ratification, AIPAC predictably lost. In that defeat, it lost more than a vote on the Iran anti-nuke deal. It lost some of its hard-won credibility as a careful, successful lobbying entity that would not engage in demonization of sitting legislators and presidents or other Jews. In the course of the Iran nuclear pact battle, some AIPAC elements also participated in demonizing J Street. That was not pretty. It's a year since then. You might expect passions had cooled, but this has been an election year, actually a year and a half at least, and the issue of Israel and the Iran deal came up repeatedly in the Republican presidential primary debates. In fact, denouncing the Iran nuke deal became a kind of litmus test for Republicans. They all professed to hate it and resolved to reverse it if elected. For Democrats, the debate wasn't over the Iran deal. Hillary Clinton worked on negotiating it when she was Secretary of State. Bernie Sanders was fully supportive of it. But Israel and the Palestinians, well, that was a real issue. And Clinton's stronger support for Israel only overcame Sanders' less vigorous support and his appointees to the platform committee of the Democratic Party in the past month. Within the Jewish community, the divide between AIPAC and J Street and the relationship between them did not improve. Recent events in Israel have sharpened that divide. The knife-wielding terror that has been the ineffective but nasty minor intifada going on for a year now included the brutal stabbing death of a girl in her bed by a Palestinian terrorist in July. It also included the execution of a downed and incapacitated Palestinian terrorist by an Israeli soldier a couple of months ago, and a harsh conflict in Israeli society over his prosecution. And the 49-year-old debate in Israel over what to do about the West Bank and its heavily Palestinian Arab population, well, that hasn't exactly been resolved. Meanwhile, in America here, Israel remains the hottest hot-button issue of all for Jews. Israel is strongly supported by the vast majority of Americans, more so than ever before, especially among non-Jews. But on our college campuses, where opinion makers are trained, and among younger and better educated Americans, including some young American Jews, the exact opposite trend is present. So what are we committed pro-Israel American Jews supposed to do about all this? The challenge for many of us who love Israel is we live 9,000 miles away from her. We are not subject to the same conditions as Israelis. Do we try to tell Israel she should resolve the Palestinian issue when no one seems to have anything like a practical, realistic solution? Do we directly criticize Israeli policies we don't like? Do we tell the truth about the massive, corrupt dysfunction that is Palestinian leadership today? Do we try to silence principled, knowledgeable Jews who criticize Israel because there are enough Israel haters out there in the world demonizing her who don't care about the facts or the ethical character of the Jewish state? And a lot of them simply hate Jews. Why should we join them in criticizing her? Or is there perhaps a different issue here? A long time ago, my father, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, protested that we were raising a whole generation of American Jewish kids on 3 points: the Holocaust, the State of Israel, and anti-Semitism. That is, our children came out of the organized Jewish community's educational system connected by a belief in eternal Jewish victimization symbolized by the horrors of the Shoah, the Holocaust, by redemption from that victimization through the miraculous creation of the new old nation of Israel, which was always viewed as embattled and endangered by Arabs and other enemies, and the reality that many people will hate us just because we are Jews. My dad's objection was that this missed most of what makes Judaism such an incredible, vital source of wisdom, joy, ethics, and meaning. It is those things we need to teach and instill in our children and remember and live out for ourselves in order for Judaism to continue to thrive in this remarkable country of America. Frankly, I love Israel, but I also love being Jewish in America, And I think it's time for the American Jewish community to change its focus, to work much harder to support and develop the great community we have right here in this land of the free. Because we are, at worst, the second most important Jewish community in the world now, and one of the most important in all of Jewish history. So let's support Judaism here in America and continue to love Israel and not spend so much time and effort attacking other Jews on this topic. To play us in this morning, in the spirit of Klal Yisrael, the peoplehood of Israel, and the brotherhood and sisterhood of our great Jewish nation, here's something all Jews can agree on, celebrating Shabbat, Uviyom HaShabbat.
שני כבשים בני שנה, בני שנה תמימים. ושני עשרונים סולת מנחה, בלולה בשמן ונזכור. שני כבשים בני שנה, בני שנה תמימים. ושני עשרונים סולת מנחה, בלולה בשמן ונזכור.
That was Uviyom HaShabbat with fine young cantors Joshua Breitzer and Daniel Mutlu. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish, Rabbi Seth Limmer, led a remarkable event last summer, a walk with the Torah from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C. It all came together quite quickly and created an extraordinary experience that unified people across the nation in an important way. Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Rabbi Seth Limmer is a senior rabbi of Chicago Sinai Congregation and was the winner of the Eisendrath Award for a remarkable social justice program last summer. In the interest of full disclosure, I have to admit he is also my cousin, which I not only admit, but I'm proud of. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish. Seth, tell us about the development of the walk from Selma to Washington, D.C. with the Torah, how that all kind of evolved.
It was really the craziest story that could be imagined. We have a colleague who's also a good friend of mine, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, who is the director of our Religious Action Center down in Washington, D.C. And he was supposed to be on a phone call about a rally in Roanoke, Virginia last summer. And we were trying to help get some rabbis to different rallies around voting rights last summer. And he was going on vacation. So he asked me to be on the phone call for him and take whatever notes needed to be taken so we could deploy people to the right place. I sat on the phone call for an hour and duly took the appropriate notes. And at the very end of the phone call, the organizer said, oh, by the way, Cornell Brooks wants 10 minutes of everybody's time. If you have the opportunity, please stay on. He has something he wants to share. I didn't even know who Cornell Brooks was at the time. He was the very recently appointed president and CEO of the NAACP. Cornell got on and shared that they were about to launch this brand new initiative around voting rights and racial justice called America's Journey for Justice. That was going to march from Selma, Alabama, all the way to Washington, D.C., under the banner, Our Lives, Our Votes, Our Jobs, and Our Education Matters. And he issued a call for any partners who wanted to come and march with them to join in the march, and that was the end of the phone call. And 5 minutes later, I picked up the phone and called another partner in crime at the Union for Reform Judaism and said, we have to do this. And I don't think there's going to be any single rabbi who can march all 40 days of America's Journey with them. But I bet we could walk each rabbi for a day and get 40 rabbis to share in this experience with them. And then these words just came out of my mouth. And what could be better than, you know, a baton to pass from rabbi to rabbi than if we carried a Torah scroll with us the entire way? That was how the whole thing got ideated, and the rest of the crazy story I can fill in the details if you want to hear them.
We definitely do. It must have been an extraordinary experience, and social justice has been an important part of your rabbinate already. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments when we come back here on Two Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey,
good morning.
Rabbi.
Quitting smoking, big part of your lives.
Yeah, it's very important. When we started this company just over 6 years ago, it was because I had a really bad cigar habit, and it was time for me to quit. We have 7 children. Our youngest just turned 8, and I wish to be around to watch them all grow up and have successful careers and family of their own.
And Pamela, it's better personally, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm a non-smoker, and being with a person who smokes cigars in particular, it's much nicer. His body doesn't reek of it, his hair does not reek of it, his clothes do not smell of it, and there's no tobacco between his teeth anymore.
And you don't have to send them for extra showers or
no,
out in the rain.
No extra
smoke.
Showers.
How can people find out more about Freedom Smoke?
You can look us up on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-705-7013. That's 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
Rabbi.
You.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of 4 activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award in 2016, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We only have 3 months left, thank God, until we elect a new president of these United States, and so we continue our 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. Last week, the Jewish War Veterans of the USA, the JWV, condemned Donald Trump's objectionable remarks about the family of a Muslim American soldier killed in Iraq. In a sharply worded news release, the group joined the chorus of individuals and groups speaking out about the Republican presidential nominee's response to the speech Humayun Khan's father gave at the Democratic National Convention. Mr. Trump has crossed the line, the Jewish veterans group said, more than one line. Captain Khan died in battle, trying valiantly to save others. He served our country. He's buried in Arlington National Cemetery, along with those of many ethnic backgrounds from religious denominations. They served our country. Mr. Trump did not. The group said Trump's characterization of Khan's mother, suggesting she stood silently during her husband's speech because her religion forbids her from speaking publicly, is vile beyond words. JWV is an apolitical organization, the veterans group said. We do not support or oppose candidates or parties. This condemnation is against you personally. You, Mr. Trump, deserve our contempt. On the flip side for Trump, a new group called Jews Choose Trump has been formed. About 650 people joined the group in the past 2 weeks. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Turkey has been a very interesting place the last several weeks. All kinds of coup stories, but the fact that there was a coup in Turkey shouldn't really be a surprise to anyone, should it?
Right, and for the sake of transparency, we should tell your listeners that we're recording this long before it will actually be broadcast.
Right.
So we are in a phase where we don't have full information yet as to what actually transpired. And there's all kinds of theories, including the theory that it was all a hoax staged by Erdogan to enhance his own power.
So there's a term for that.
A coup de théâtre.
Right. I love that. It's a French term.
It theatrical means move, basically.
Fake.
Like a coup de grâce, right. Whatever. But I mean, the thing is, historically, there's a lot of precedent. And when I first heard the news that the military was staging a coup in Turkey, I was actually optimistic because the traditional role of the military in Turkey is to safeguard the vision of Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, which was a vision of a secular democratic republic where religion was not part and parcel of being a citizen of the republic. So no past civilian government since Atatürk has really threatened the secular part of that vision. But there have been a number of governments which have threatened the democratic part of that vision. And in every case, the military stepped in, seized power, removed a leader that it perceived as undemocratic or anti-democratic or corrupt, and governed the country on an interim basis, usually 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, not a long-term thing, until they could form a new government and return the country to what the military sees as the right path. All right, so this is the first leader in modern Turkish history who not only threatened the democratic part of that vision, but also the secular part of that vision. And really, it was a question of time until the military actually stepped in. Now, knowing this, Erdogan removed a lot of the most powerful military people about 2 years ago, and people who he considered potential enemies or sources of the possible initiative to stage a coup were removed. So at this point, we don't know if this was a real coup attempt that was just poorly executed or if it was a hoax arranged by Erdogan to enhance his own power. What we do know is that the Turkish military is the second biggest military in NATO and probably among the very best. So if it had staged a coup on its own, it is likely that it would have succeeded.
Fascinating. You know, in Turkey, we're both, I think, fans of Turkey as a country and as a deeply interesting place. And the friends that I've had there haven't been very optimistic about Erdogan, but also saw him as effective at retaining power. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Oshrat Bar-El, our Mevina on Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, who is here today with two very special guests whom we'll hear much more about over the course of time. And I'd like her to introduce them. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you?
Well, thank you.
So just came back from Israel, as you know. And also, and brought with me like a huge treasure, I would say. Yeah, so Bar and Leah, both of them 18 years old, just graduated from high school in Israel. And they are volunteering, like they are postponing their army service in Israel just to volunteer here in Tucson and work with the with the Jewish community and actually the broader community here in Tucson and help us connect Tucson with Israel. That's the idea of their staying here for a year.
So this program called Shin Shinim is a really extraordinary program. It's a partnership of a lot of different organizations, including, in the interest of full disclosure, Temple Emmanuel, my own temple. Let's meet them. So, Bar, welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello. Hey, Rabbi. My name is Bar Al-Gahar, and I came here to be Shin Shin in Tucson. 18 years old, coming out of the north of Israel in Shimshit. It's close to Nazareth. And really just came here about a few hours ago and really excited coming here and learning about Tucson and bringing my own thing to the city and to the Jewish life.
Fantastic. So you're from the Galil, kind of the near Nazareth, Nazareth. Very different than Tucson. What's your first impression?
Really sweaty. But it was where I live, it's about 30 degrees lower Fahrenheit. So it's a big difference to a little struggle.
Welcome to the desert of the Southwest.
Very hot.
Welcome, and we're delighted to have you. And Leah, let's hear about you a little bit.
Hi, I'm Leah. I'm 18. I was born in Ethiopia, and I made Aliyah when I was about 3. And right now I live in Kiryat Malachi, which is the partnership region with Tucson.
So how old were you when you came from Ethiopia to Israel?
About 3.
About 3 years old.
Yeah.
Do you remember Ethiopia at all?
No, I don't remember Ethiopia, but I do remember growing up in a Ethiopian community in Israel. Just an environment of new immigrants from Russia and like from all over the world, but specifically from Ethiopia. And so it was like a little Ethiopia in a city, Lod. And then I moved to Kiryat Malachi, actually.
To Kiryat Malachi from Lod.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of Israel represented geographically, and we're very excited to have you guys here. And we'll have a chance to talk to you more extensively on another show. But for now, Bruchim Habaim, welcome.
Thank
to Southern Arizona, and welcome to America.
Toda rabba.
Oshrat, we will talk next week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Good morning, John.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So it's time to go back to school.
Yes.
You know, in Arizona, we do that earlier than most of the world, but it's right upon us. What's exciting about going back to school?
So many things are exciting. It kind of depends who you ask. When you ask the administrator, the head of school, the principal, the custodial team, right? It's we're just excited to see everybody coming back. You know, summers tend to be long, but they somehow go by very quickly. And there's an excitement, there's an energy that builds and builds and builds and then peaks on that first day of school. So yesterday, teachers returned. We have our big back to school meeting with the whole team tomorrow. It's a very exciting time. So if you're a kid, you might be looking forward to seeing your friends and curious, maybe a little anxious about what are my new teachers like, if you have new teachers, and you know, something they're excited to learn about or one of their favorite things about school coming back. And parents, as much as we love our children, parents get a little fatigued over the summer, and they always seem to be very ready for the school year to start, even though I know it's bittersweet. The first day of kindergarten or that first day of eighth grade, a lot of mixed emotions, but anticipation is high.
You know, kids have a different sense about going back to school. I have to say, while they complain and they really don't want to go, they are very excited to see their friends. Are they really excited about learning?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I was literally walking my dog Tuesday evening, and a minivan stopped. I was right by Fort Lowell Park. A minivan pulls up. Hey, Mr. Ben Asher. And it's a van full of kids. And, you know, I leaned in. How's everybody doing? Great to see you. Of course, they look big and grown and all that. And I said, are you ready for school, or are you going to miss the summer? And one of them was like, I can't wait to come back to school. I've been looking forward to it all summer long.
Wow.
So each one's different.
Probably worth an ice cream, that comment. You know, as a day school and teaching Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
it's amazing how much kids seem to forget. We see it in our religious schools too. You know, they were reading well in May. They come right in August, and you sort of have to reteach alphabet sometimes.
Sure. It's you know, those of you who go to the gym and then pause, you know what it's like when you come back. It's true with our brains also. When they get time off and the structure's different and the amount of thinking and learning and, you know, kind of academic work shifts, the brain responds to that. So we actually talked in July about some strategies to retain some of that learning over the summer. And, you know, every year we take kids where they are at the beginning and we bring them along as far as we can over the course of the year. So teachers figure out what's the current level of performance, what are the current needs, what are the opportunities for stretching and challenges, and then they apply education accordingly.
It's good to be back. And we'll talk more about education next week. Thanks, John.
I wish everybody a great school year.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish is a public service. Abe and Judith, elderly residents at the old age home, are sitting next to each other. Suddenly, Abe says to Judith, I bet you can't guess how old I am. I bet I can, replies Judith. Well, I'll bet you can't, says Abe. You're on, says Judith. Now, please stand up so I can properly investigate you. Abe stands. Judith looks him up and down. Now turn around, says Judith. Abe turns around. Judith looks him up and down. Now turn back around and drop your trousers, says Judith. So Abe does that. Judith looks him up and down, and then she says, you are 86 years old. Abe is amazed. He can't believe what he just heard. Oy vey, Judith, he says, you're absolutely right. I am 86 years old. How on earth did you work that out? Judith smiles at him and replies, you told me yesterday. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well.
And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Devarim, Deuteronomy, final book in the Torah. Deuteronomy begins at the end of the Israelites' journey to the borders of Canaan, the promised land, soon to become Israel. Moses informs the people of Israel he has now led them for 40 years, and they have come to a place and time of the greatest importance. He recalls the time when the Israelites were beginning to organize and appointed judges and magistrates to help him with the needs of the people. Moses recalls the instructions he gave those leaders. Be fair and absolutely even-handed in dispensing justice. Do not favor the rich. Do not favor the poor. Show no partiality, but simply seek that which is just and right in the world. This is just the beginning of Moses' long orations in Deuteronomy, his last hurrah. Although he is now, by biblical calculation, 120 years old, though his control over his people has waned, his speech is tinged by the bitter knowledge he will not be permitted to enter the promised land. Still, he teaches, yet again, the greatest lesson. In an uncertain and often unjust world, we Jews must be pledged to create acts and systems of ethics and justice. What greater calling could any people have? When we come back here on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Seth Limmer, winner of the 2015 Eisendrath Bearer of Light Award for creating a remarkable Torah walk for justice from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C. last summer, will discuss what racial justice means for Jews today, right here when we come back on Two Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Proving that causes that address one important problem often go wildly astray, the wide-ranging new platform of a coalition growing out of the Black Lives Matter movement includes harsh criticism of Israel, which it describes as an apartheid state that it claims perpetrates genocide against the Palestinian people. Released just this last week, the platform of the Movement for Black Lives calls for an end to the war against black people. Black Lives Matter Network is one of over 50 black-led organizations within the coalition. While the majority of the document addresses issues other than Israel, like racial injustice in America, the section on foreign policy, titled Invest Divest, objects to U.S. military aid to Israel, which it describes as a state that practices systematic discrimination and has maintained a military occupation of Palestine for decades. The section addresses other foreign policy issues, particularly the movement's objections to the drug war and the war on terror, but it criticizes no foreign country other than Israel. It argues that the U.S., because of its alliance with Israel, is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people. It's always distressing when people mistakenly throw around terms like genocide and apartheid when they are absolutely not what's going on. It is more distressing still when a movement seeking justice for African Americans in this country goes off the rails and starts attacking Israel. In happier news, Israel sent its largest Olympic delegation ever to the Rio Games, taking place right now. 48 qualifying athletes competing in 16 different sports. There are also a number of Jewish Olympians on the American team, including gymnast Ali Reisman, captain of the women's gymnastics team and defending gold medalist in floor exercises, who, if you recall the London Games in 2012, did her routine to Hava Nagila. And who says the thinnest book ever is called Great Jewish Athletes? Not anymore. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Seth Limmer, is the senior rabbi of Chicago Sinai Congregation. He, on behalf of the congregation, but really through his initiative, was received from the Union for Reform Judaism the Eisendrath Award for really the most dramatic and important social justice program in America in the Reform movement last year for the Walk with the Torah from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C., which involved a group of rabbis carrying the Torah as part of a march for justice. Why did you feel so passionate about our need to be connected to the march last year?
My passion to organize our colleagues and thereby the Reform movement to do the work of racial justice started earlier. There's a cadre of rabbis who have been sort of focused on trying to spread and deepen the work of racial justice in the movement, and we had decided just about 6 months before this opportunity arose that we really needed to figure out how to take the brokenness America was experiencing that came to light starting with Ferguson and figure out a way for Reform Jews to start healing that wound. And so really, when the opportunity to march came around, I had a sense that there just might be 40 colleagues who would be committed to taking this symbolic step with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And I had in the back of my mind that very inspirational picture, I think, that most of our colleagues look to and say, that's the kind of rabbi I want to be, of Rabbi Maurice Eisendrath or Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel carrying the Torah and walking with Dr. King. I thought that image and trying to bring that to life in the modern day would be inspiring, that maybe we could get 40 people involved. And the amazing thing was, once we sent out the call, hoping to get 40, over 200 colleagues responded. And in the end, more than one out of every 10 Reform rabbis in America during the month of the year when it's vacation time or high holiday sermon writing time flew to places in the Deep South that they had never heard of before, did this march, and then went back and spoke to their congregations about it, spoke about the need for us to get involved in racial healing and racial justice in America, and have helped keep it a continuous topic that Reform Jews know is an exponent of how we live our Jewish values in the world today. So it was, we were thinking about it, the right opportunity came around, and clearly we struck a nerve with Jews across America who really want to do this work and are looking for a way to both show solidarity and partnership and a willingness to learn.
Like many Reform rabbis, we were raised with that great picture of Abraham Joshua Heschel marching hand in hand with Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King. That's not the reality today in many communities of the African-American Jewish relationship. Can you make some observations about that?
You know, this is where the academics come in and are either helpful or not. I wasn't a rabbi in the 70s when the great bonds that existed locally and nationally between the leadership of Black America and the leadership of the Reform movement started to not sever, but just not be as strong as they used to be.
You could say we simply went on somewhat divergent paths.
I think that's true. Some have said that there was a movement towards Black militant language. Some said that there was a movement, that Stokely Carmichael certainly represented this, of the African-American community wanted to do it for themselves without other partners. Certainly in the Reform movement, there was a return to liturgy and ritual that took a lot of space and energy with a growing ferment of exponents from Camp and Demi Friedman and new prayer books that really occupied the center of what the Reform movement was about for the next 20 years. So I think we did kind of grow apart for a little bit. What was encouraging for me to learn both before the march and since is that growing apart was something many rabbis regretted and were looking for ways to heal and fix. And especially young rabbis within the first 5 years of their career, they want to be about rebuilding those relationships, which I think we have in profound ways. When the president and CEO of the NAACP, Cornell Brooks, is constantly on the phone with Reform rabbis, planning how to do work for the future, and we're trying to navigate voting rights and all sorts of different campaigns together. On a national level, that's in place, and we've encouraged all of our rabbis to build those relationships locally so we can, instead of analyzing the reasons why we've grown apart, instead refocus the work of being together and doing this work together.
Tell us some of the stories, the most interesting stories of the experience during the walk. What are some of the really surprising, what was the most surprising thing that happened? What was the most interesting thing?
The most surprising thing that happened grew out of watching rabbis posting on Facebook. Rabbis would be walking down the highway and it was time for a break and they would unroll the Torah scroll and teach it. Or they would be walking down the highway and a group of state troopers in Alabama came along and wanted to know why they were carrying this funny-looking object. And they would explain what it is. And the next thing you knew, there's a picture of an Alabama state trooper and a rabbi, and the trooper is holding the Torah scroll. Right? The opportunity to teach and show how the values of Torah came to life was far and away the most powerful and sustained Jewish aspect of the Journey for Justice. I will say personally, we rabbis, our main stock is metaphor, right? We either take metaphors and apply them to daily life or take ancient biblical things that we don't really care for and turn them into a metaphor. That's how we teach, right? And I've been doing it for thousands of years.
I think it's called Midrash.
Something like that, right? And the amazing thing that I experienced walking on that first day of the journey down 12 miles of over 100 degree heat in Selma, Alabama, is that when you are actually carrying the physical scroll of the Torah and taking the first steps of a journey that are over 1,000 miles long, over 40 days, right? And you know you're not going to finish the journey, but other people are actually going to come and take that Torah and bring it forward, any possibility for metaphor collapses. And I was literally living every metaphor I've ever tried to teach about Jewish life and values. And that for me was a remarkable opportunity and a sacred moment that I got to share.
Who did you end up walking with the most? Was it ministers? Was it lay people?
It really depended on the day. You know, I only did the first day and the last day of the march, but I'll try and explain. When the march approached a major city like Raleigh, there were not only 10 to 15 rabbis, but there were 20 to 50 pastors and 100 volunteers. And on those days, I think rabbis found ministers and other leaders and walked with them, whether we're aristocratic in that sense or like finds like, I won't comment. But on most days of the march, you know, when you were in some of the real rural places in the Carolinas or in Georgia, there might have only have been 12 people doing the 20 miles of marching that day. And one of them was a rabbi, and the other 12 people were volunteers from, you know, local NAACP or national staff. And so there was, it was really all different kinds of people with whom we marched. But one, of course, comes to mind in a both a beautiful and a tragic way. There was a man I met on the first day who introduced himself to me by his name, Middle Passage. It was not the name he was given at birth. It was the name he took on to carry the weight of his African-American history. And he was a veteran of the Vietnam War. And he decided that he wanted to carry the flag for the entire Journey for Justice. And he was there every day. He is probably the person that more people connected with. He marched the whole march. Another social justice advocate named Kashia Thomas walked the whole march. And Middle Passage was gregarious and fun-loving and carried that flag with the dignity that you would hope every American might. And unfortunately, 10 days before the march ended, there was a terrible rainstorm in Virginia. And he did what you do with a flag when you're carrying it in a rainstorm. He covered it. He wrapped it properly and covered it. And then the sun came out and it was beautiful again. He unfurled the flag, he lifted it back up to its position and dropped out of a heart attack on the road.
Oh my God.
And literally in the middle of the Journey for Justice. I think if there's one thing that many of our colleagues will remember from that march or anybody who walked was either having the opportunity to meet Middle Passage or dealing with the last 10 days of the march and carrying on, not only in the name of everything we needed for racial justice in America, but finishing the march for him.
Who carried the flag after that?
I will say that I do not know.
But it's an incredible story.
It is. And he was actually, he had a wonderful testimony given to him not only at our URJ biennial, but also at the NAACP convention last month in Cleveland.
I had the privilege of being there when you received the award with your family. What's the carry forward? You know, you guys carried this flag. I carried the Torah. He carried the flag, sorry. You carried the Torah. You brought this connection. It's a tremendous symbolic moment. I'm always interested in the follow-through.
Yeah, and I think that was really another personal takeaway is I didn't earn the right to carry the Torah by anything I did before the march. It's everything that I do after the march that will earn the right to have done so. And I feel a tremendous sense of obligation. That we have kept our focus on our racial justice campaign and just last week announced the major effort of the Reform Movement trying to unite all 1,800 congregations is going to be around voting for this current election. The 2016 presidential election is the first one since Dr. King has passed without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And we are all very concerned about it. We've been working with the NAACP on a national campaign. We've been working with partners like the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And our work really has three main aspects. It's the work of voter registration, and then voter turnout, and ultimately on Election Day itself, voter protection. We have a huge opening rally and kickoff where all the leaders of the Reform Movement will be gathered with the leaders of the NAACP and congregational leaders in North Carolina in the Raleigh-Durham area for a kickoff weekend on April 18th. Tu B'Av, our love holiday. This is about loving everybody and making sure they have the right to vote. And then a weekend of voter registration in the Carolinas. And we have plans that are being released to congregations who want to participate to do voter registration locally, and then in coming months to do voter turnout locally. And then we have a very big effort that we're just about, that we have announced, but we're finalizing the details. We're going to try and get somewhere between 100 and 200 rabbis and 1,000 and 2,000 of the attorneys in their congregation to travel together and do voter protection at polling precincts in the most vulnerable states, given new laws that have been passed in the wake of the Shelby versus Holder decision that eradicated the Voting Rights Act. So that's so we have a major focus on trying to register people to vote, get them to vote, and protect their vote come Election Day. And that's the main focus of our racial justice campaign through November.
Where can people go to find out more about that or to get updated on voting rights activities and on this campaign?
In the Reform Movement, the place is RAC.org, RAC.org, ReligiousActionCenter.org. You can find out all the details of the Nitzavim campaign there. Hopefully, if you're a member of a Reform synagogue, you can also go to your congregational rabbi or social action chair and look at it and together figure out all the different ways that your congregation could be involved, which ways you might want to get involved.
I want to thank Rabbi Seth Limmer for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And again, Mazel Tov on receiving the Eisendrath Award last year and for carrying it forward. People want to find out more, they can go to RAC.org, RAC.org. They can also find out more about you at ChicagoSinai.org, correct?
That is true, but I'd rather they go to RAC.org and get involved in voting rights.
A last question. Is there anything more important for a contemporary Jew, in your view, than activity in social justice?
I don't think there's anything more important, actually, no. I think there are other things of equal importance. I do believe that any Jewish identity needs to be diverse and rich. And even those people who are most dedicated to justice work and see that as the strongest exponent of who they are as a Jew, I would still encourage them, you know, every once in a while to do something in the spiritual worship realm, or every once in a while to do something in the learning realm. Our desire to do justice is nourished by the texts that we inherit and bring forward, and it's nourished by the opportunity to be in a prayerful community that uses our worship to feed what we do. So I don't think there's anything more important, but I also don't think that it's the only important thing, and hopefully the same way we should all have well-balanced diets for our dietary health, I think for our spiritual health, we also need well-balanced diets that have social justice as a main component, but have worship, prayer, community, learning as other major parts of the puzzle as well.
Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Sam. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure. We'll see each other in person, I hope, soon.
You got it. Thanks so much. Take care.
You're very welcome. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Ron Wolfson, PhD, and author of the important book Relational Judaism. Our playout for the coming of Tisha B'Av, the commemoration of the destruction of the First and Second Temples, observed this coming Saturday night and next Sunday, comes from Neshama Karlbach. Nachamu Ami, be comforted, my people. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Nachamu, Nachamu Ami.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.